Welcome to Stupid Not Stupid. I'm Matt, here with my man Jason, the co-host who has an official coffee cup confirming that he is the world's best co-host.
Actually, I want to get one of those made now.
Yeah. What are you drinking out of your coffee cup there that says world's best co-host?
That's right. Well, next to it, I've got a glass of Guinness, because once again, you're on the opposite coast.
Yeah, should we set the scene? We're still recording remotely here to let everybody know.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm still on the East Coast. You're out on the West Coast. So I'm left to fend for myself, left to my own devices. I've got a Guinness, and I actually opened up your Christmas present. I went to Ohio to go visit my dad and picked up a bottle of that Magnolia bourbon that I got about a year ago. But last time I'd come back, I had the red label, which was not as good as the blue label that I'd had. And this time I found the blue label, so I brought you back some, and you know, there might even be some left by the time you get home.
Like that guy who buys the box of chocolates but like picks out all the non-gross ones before you hand it over.
Yeah, all right.
Well, I have a little bit of a tradition going here. I think this is the third time we've done it, and looking here at the bottle, there's about three drinks worth missing from the bottle now that I've poured it. I am back to, you may or may not remember this, Jason, Ballantini's Finest Blended Scotch.
That's right, yeah. We made all the jokes about, you know, only the finest scotch is made in Italy. Yeah.
It is not the fine. It is the maybe the finest scotch from Italy, but it is not the finest scotch. But I felt like, I don't know, every year where we've done this, I have cracked this singular bottle open that's been sitting in the basement here at my childhood home and poured a drink. So I'm just going to keep doing that.
I like that. I like the tradition. That's nice.
Yeah. We're rolling with Ballantini. Well, we haven't done this in a few episodes. So it's time for
Matt and Jason are stupid.
You suck.
Give your
balls
a top.
So I think, Jason, you mentioned to me before the show you had a war stupid. I have one also, but I think yours goes back further than mine because I have one from our last episode. You want to go first?
Yeah. So my we're stupid jumps back to the Halloween episode. On that episode where we were talking about the most stupid and least stupid ways to hide a body, we were talking about a movie that we couldn't come up with the title. I thought that Kevin Bacon was in it, and you thought that Hugh Jackman was in it. And I went back.
We were both wrong.
Yeah, we were both completely wrong. So the movie was called The Vanishing, and the version that I was talking about was actually a 1993 remake of a 1988 French-Dutch film. And the U.S. remake starred Jeff Bridges, Kiefer Sutherland, Nancy Travis, and Sandra Bullock. So we were just way off.
So were we both thinking of Kiefer Sutherland, who is an amalgamation of Kevin Bacon and who did I say?
Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman, yeah. So if you put together Hugh Jackman and Kevin Bacon, would you get Kiefer Sutherland? I mean, is that our out here?
That sounds non-stupid to me.
All right, well my worst stupid, my correction from a previous episode is from our episode last week. I don't know if this isn't actually a correction, but I felt stupid listening to myself say it, so I wanted to go back and add a little extra context. In the show, or in our episode on a wealth cap, like, is it stupid or not stupid to institute a wealth cap?
Right.
I made the point that in the last 9 years, I have moved from the bottom 14% to the upper 8% of earners in the United States. So right. I was in the 14% of earners, and now I am in the 92nd percent of earners. And that is a very douchey thing to say on the surface.
But I was just going to let it ride. Yeah.
But I wanted to contextualize that and make the point that I wasn't pointing that out to show how wealthy I've become. I was pointing that out to demonstrate the absurdity of the fact that the distance that I traveled to go from 14 to 93 is about one millionth of what I would have to travel to go from like 93 to 96.
Right.
And that was the real problem I was trying to point out. So I wasn't trying to tell everyone how wealthy I was. I was trying to poorly and without actually landing the point, drive home the fact that we have a serious income inequality problem in the United States.
Yes. And to that point, you know, not to heap more discussion of a previous topic on this show, but I think both of us kind of made relatively similar moves. But it's also important to remember in terms of context that during that time period, I also finished two master's degrees and have been working for 10 years in one of the most expensive parts of the country. So my salary is actually adjusted for an increase for living in this particular area as well. So I think that both of our salaries sound higher to the rest of the country than they actually are when it comes to the spending power that we have in the area that we live.
Okay, so now we've suitably padded our remarks from the previous episode. We're not as rich as we may have led you to believe.
That's right. That's exactly correct.
Okay, well, speaking of the way we go about earning a living, I was reflecting today, Jason, and I was really reminiscing on the fact that, you know, working in an office is quickly becoming a thing of the past, and it's a way of life. It's a part of American culture. It's something that I think, I don't know, the modern office as we know it is really a post-World War II conception, but it's something that's quickly going the way of the dodo. And I think it's important, you know, as historians, I qualify us both as historians, that we immortalize the practice of working in an office by putting it on the official record of humanity, otherwise known as this podcast, and lock right. it in.
I like that. Lock stupid, not stupid. The official the official accounting of U.S. of American history. Yes.
Yeah.
Or human history.
And if we are going to immortalize the modern American office workplace in some way, then what better way to do it than by discussing the show The Office?
I like that.
But then I started thinking about the show, The Office, and I began to ponder what our ant overlords of the future who go back and look at the capstone that we leave behind when they watch the show, when they hear us talk about it here, and they go back to the Library of Congress and find the USB drives that contain all the seasons of the right. American version of The Office. There's a particular plot thread that sort of goes unresolved over, I think The Office is like 9 seasons.
That sounds right.
There's a particular... Yeah. Yeah, something like that. But there's a particular plot thread that never gets resolved over the course of those seasons, and it is the identity of the Scranton Strangler, the notorious serial killer who stalks the night of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and literally takes the breath away from its inhabitants. And because we don't get a definitive answer from the showrunners one way or the other, the identity of the Scranton Strangler, it's hanging out there. But it's something I've thought a lot about. It's something I've dedicated a lot of energy to, and a considerable amount of the financial resources that I have at my disposal, as discussed in our most recent episode. And I think that I've arrived at a place where I'm ready to have a discussion and like I said, put that discussion here into our time capsule, Jason. And the question I want to pose is, stupid or not stupid, the Scranton Strangler worked in The Office. So they actually worked at... The Scranton Strangler is an employee of Dunder Mifflin. That's
nice.
The question that
okay.
I want to put forward.
So now,
I don't know if you have any strong feelings on this off the bat.
No, I've seen, you know, probably a couple dozen episodes of The Office, but I don't consider myself to be like a giant fan of the show. Like, I enjoyed the show. I thought it was very funny. I'm familiar with who the characters are. But when you brought this topic up, and by the way, that just came up like earlier today.
Yeah.
So I've done absolutely no prep work for this episode at all, which is also very typical. It occurred to me, like when you said the Scranton Strangler, you know, works in The Office, and I thought to myself, was the Scranton Strangler a real thing and he's just trying to like shoehorn this into a TV show, or was this part of a plot line that I just totally missed on that show?
Or like the Scranton Strangler is a real serial killer who works in like our shared office.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
the call's
exactly.
coming from inside the house. Jason. Well, for the benefit of you then, Jason, and for the benefit of anyone else listening who isn't super familiar with that specific plot point or maybe didn't even watch The Office, there is a thing called the Office Wiki Fandom. So a website dedicated to all things Office. Every term from The Office is sussed out by season, gives you the name of the episode and the context in which mentions of things comes up, deep bios and rundowns on all the characters. Even includes a dedicated section to Scranton Strangler theory, which we drew from a little bit for this. But this is the definition from that website on the Scranton Strangler. It says, the Scranton Strangler is a nickname for an unseen serial criminal in Scranton. A man named George Howard Scubb goes to prison after being convicted of being the Strangler, although Toby, who served on the jury that convicted him, believed Scubb was innocent. And that's the official bio of the Scranton Strangler. on their website. So that's kind of our baseline context here.
Okay. So now we're going to go through and examine the various characters and see who could and could not have been the Grant and the Strangler, is what you're saying.
Well, I think that makes sense. It's historically proven to be the best approach to solving history's most pervasive and persistent mysteries, to take that approach on this show. We just go in order from what I believe to be the least likely to the most likely, and we burn through them and come up with, I guess what we really do is we check off one by one, stupid or not stupid, this person could be it, and then we make a call at the end.
That sounds good. It's interesting that we're trying to solve a murder tonight. Last night, I just watched the new Knives Out movie, The Glass Onion, and the way that they solve that film is very different from the approach that we're going to take.
I thought you were going to say you strangled someone last night. Oh, but, no. I'm glad that went a different direction.
That was like the night before. Right, yeah.
All right, so the most, I guess, in a traditional sense, the most sus, the creepiest, or the, maybe let's say the character of whom we know the least about on The Office is the character of Creed. So Creed is the quality assurance guy. So the old guy who basically does nothing, fakes his job, and just enough to stay under the radar, collect a paycheck, but no one's really sure what he does and is constantly sort of in the background.
Yes.
So in your cursory viewing, in your kind of your armchair jumping in and out from season to season viewing of The Office, you're familiar with Creed. Like you kind of get the character that is Creed,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do. And my opinion of Creed as a character, because I have witnessed people similar to this in my own professional career trajectory over the years. He's one of those guys that, like, he works so hard to not do work that if he just did the work, it would actually be less effort. So, given that that's
why. But in another way, though, you have to respect the hustle, though, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But again, though, like, the idea that he works so hard to do nothing makes it less likely to me that he would actually go out and kill somebody. It seems like if he had that predilection, he would work really hard to not do it.
To not get caught. Well, I think you and I are kind of maybe going the same direction with this, but what I'm going to do is I'll throw out a few examples of incidents that occurred or things Creed said or did that may implicate him in, well, maybe not like being the strangler specifically, but certainly having a shady criminal element that is at least murder adjacent, or at least that may create a reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury that convicted the quote unquote actual Scranton Strangler. So the other thing I'm worried about in this episode is we're going to have to insert a lot of clips.
Yeah.
But be prepared for that. But the first one we have here is in the murder in the bayou. Then the bayou? Bayou? How do you say bayou? Is it bayou?
It is
the
bayou.
Murder in the bayou episode, which is like one of the greatest Office episodes of all time. This is the one where they find the dinner party game, and it's like a whodunit. Everyone has a character, and they're trying to figure out like who the murderer is.
Yeah.
And they just start the game, and Creed walks in late, and Michael turns to him and says,
"Sir! There has been a murder, and you are a suspect."
And Creed, like, freezes, turns, and just runs out of the office and jumps in his car and, like, peels out and drives out of the parking lot. So without the context of knowing what they were talking about, that it was just, like, a party game, Creed walks in, is accused of murder, takes it seriously, assumes he's been found out, and makes a run for it. So that's suspicious to me on the surface, Jason.
It could be. Or he walked in, saw that they were playing a game, and just wanted no part of it because it would actually require effort on his part. And
that was the
fastest way out.
Man, you would be a pretty solid criminal defense attorney, Jason. I haven't even presented all my arguments, and you have me convinced. There's another extremely suspect episode with Creed in one of the Halloween episodes. Creed comes in totally covered in blood, just like head to toe, like splattered with blood. And they do one of those cutaways, right, where they're doing like the one-on-one interviews, like the talking head interview. They pull him into their room and Creed basically goes like,
"It's Halloween. That is really, really good timing."
That's amazing. It reminds me, there was a comedian I saw years ago who used to do this routine. He said, "One of my favorite tricks to do is splash a little water on my face and go running into a dry cleaner and just go, 'Hey, can y'all get blood out of clothes? I mean, a lot of blood.'"
So we have a couple incidents there with Creed either trying to flee the scene of a crime or showing up shortly after leaving the scene of a crime. But at the end, in the final episode of The Office, Creed is arrested and taken away in handcuffs for unspecified reasons. So they don't say like actually what he did, and it cuts to Dwight. And I believe what Dwight says is Creed was taken away for either faking his own death, selling the meat of endangered species, or stealing weapons-grade LSD from the government at some point in the 60s or 70s, or maybe a combination of all of those things. He wasn't really sure. So, look, if the end of The Office is the culmination of this, like, documentary that's being put together, and so they didn't want to invest, like, the 9 or 11 years or whatever, how many other seasons we said there were of The Office, that went into making the documentary. So if there was a serial killer in their midst this whole time, they might want to put a positive spin on it. Maybe, you know, Dwight doesn't want to get the whole story to get out and all of them to lose their 15 minutes of fame because everything's focused on the Scranton Strangler Creed. So perhaps we had the answer all along and Creed was the strangler and they solved it. It just didn't make it in the documentary.
So the last point is the hardest one for me to refute. But the second point you made about the Halloween episode where he shows up covered in blood and just says that that's convenient. Well, the only issue with that is we're not talking about the Scranton Mangler, right? We're talking about the Scranton Strangler. And generally speaking, you don't end up covered in blood by strangling someone.
Well, so, unless they fight back. I mean, I don't know. It could have been one of his earlier kills. Like, we don't know, Jason.
Well, maybe he was a serial killer. He just wasn't the Scranton Strangler.
Or maybe he converted to strangulation after that maiming and realizing he got lucky that it was on October 31st and he didn't want to attempt to fade again.
Traded in his chainsaw for some leather gloves. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I'll throw out on Creed is that you've made a really good point right at the top, right at the very beginning. Creed put a lot of work into and was basically a master of flying under the radar, like not getting caught, like skating by in a job for multiple decades without like literally ever doing anything. Right. And in the instances where things got wrong that did fall under his purview, like the episode where the watermark of Bugs Bunny, like having sex, goes out on all the paper and he finds a way to blame it on someone else who took a sick day.
Right.
Like he's a master of this stuff. So if Creed was the Scranton Strangler, I believe that we wouldn't even have any evidence to discuss here to implicate him.
Yeah.
Because he would be that good. Right.
Yeah.
Like he would be the person we would least suspect.
Right. Right. And he definitely would have, if he were doing that, he would probably, you know, because he was really good at not just staying under the radar, but also throwing other people under the bus. So,
right.
We would definitely have found some kind of clues implicating somebody else in the office.
Yeah. So that's why I think Creed's off the hook. I'm not saying he wasn't a serial killer.
Right.
I'm with you on this one.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Creed definitely could have been a murderer. He just wasn't the Scranton Strangler.
Yeah. Well, that leads to an interesting theory I have further down the road, but we'll deal with that towards the end of the episode.
Okay. All right. So we're saying stupid on Creed for the Scranton Strangler then?
Sure. Yes, I think so.
Okay, cool. Well, then the next person I want to hit, and the evidence is still a little shaky here on this one, but we got to talk about Kevin. So Kevin certainly is the most physically imposing member of the office crew. He also seems to, you know, suffer from some sort of social anxiety or like misfit toy syndrome, right? Like he's on the outlier. He's an outlier. It's heavily implied throughout the season, although they get a little bit more politically correct as it goes on, that he has a deep addiction to pornography and is doing all kinds of stuff on his computer at work that he should have been doing.
Right.
None of that necessarily creates some sort of like glaring suspicion that Kevin might be the Scranton Strangler, although you do wonder what was in that chili that he spilled in that famous scene.
Yes. Yeah.
As he's walking in all over the carpet. But there's one kind of throwaway thing. If you're watching the episode where they're looking at hiring Kevin's band, Scrantonicity, for Andy's wedding, they have like a promo reel that they have that it's like a VHS tape and they pop it in and it's him and his band playing. And as they're playing a bunch of titles, like, you know, on those old infomercials that would play like in the 90s of the songs, like scrolling down the screen. So like one song, they're like playing one song in the background, but they flash the titles of other songs. You know
right.
what I'm talking
yeah.
about?
Yeah, know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
So if you slow that down and zoom in, these are the titles of the cover songs for Kevin's band. Walking in Your Footsteps. Oh My God. King of Pain. Murder by Numbers. And then the final song, Every Breath You Take.
So here's a, this, I love that this is happening right now on this podcast. It's so fucking funny to me that you're reading that as, and thinking that those are all songs that implicate him. Those are all songs by the Police.
Right. So no, that was going to be my next thing. So they're all the one that's playing while, so the song that's superimposed playing over it is Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Yeah.
And so all of them have like, look, when you look at it through the lens of the Scranton Strangler, there's a connotation with each of these songs.
Well, except Walking in Your Footsteps is about dinosaurs.
Yeah, or it could be about stalking your prey into the deepest hours of the night.
Except it's not. So Scrantonicity being a Police cover band is very funny. I actually had not seen that episode, and I like that idea. The other issue with Kevin is he comes across as very childlike and sort of emotionally stunted.
Yeah, but when you say emotionally stunted, though, imagine how disconnected and emotionally stunted you would have to be to literally strangle the life out of somebody. Like, you're talking eye contact, you're talking about close proximity. Like, you would almost need that muted sense of humanity to be able to go through with the horrific act.
You've put a lot of thought into this.
I think I'm just going to pour another Ballantini's and move on to the next topic. Honestly, I don't want to give Kevin a bad name. I don't have any other evidence on Kevin except, like, if you were going to line them all up, like Kaiser's or Usual Suspect style,
right,
and have them go through a lineup and they say, like, which is the person that tried to strangle you, like, 9 times out of 10, you know that the victim on the other side of the glass is going to pick Kevin every time. Like, Kevin is just the one who looks the most like a strangler. So that's really all I got. Kevin seems like he would be the strangler, and that the cover songs that his band plays all seem to have a murder connotation. All right, so we're saying... Are we ready to make a call yet on Kevin, or are we saying stupid or not stupid on Kevin?
I think Kevin being the strangler is kind of stupid.
Okay, so Kevin is stupid and Kevin being the strangler is stupid.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, now we'll get to some of the higher profile members of the cast. Unless, is there one you want to throw out, Jason, or you just want me to keep hitting the list here?
No, I've got a suspect of my own, but I'll throw it out towards the end because I don't have a lot of evidence for it.
Okay. Well, I'll just keep going down the list of usual suspects here. But America's hero, Jim Halpert, like the boy that stole the hearts of every girl from 2010 to 2017, or I don't know what the years were that the Office ran.
Right.
America's sweetheart, Jim Halpert.
Yes.
Let's really take a step back and let's look at Jim for a minute. The goofy young man who grew up before our eyes and gave us America's greatest love story.
Right.
Jim is basically a bully and a stalker.
Yeah.
Like, the entire premise of the first, like, what, 4 seasons of that show are Jim trying to break up a relationship between one of his coworkers who is engaged to another one of his coworkers, and then constantly harassing and bullying his deskmate, Dwight. Right. I know we like to look at Dwight kind of as the antagonistic villain of the show here, but when you really look at it, Dwight is very ant-like, which means I respect him a lot. He is completely emotional. He's totally focused on productivity. He is basically the ideal employee who's just turning out results over and over again, consistently the top paper salesman in his company, head down, coloring hard every day. And Jim is just there torturing him and berating him, making his life a living hell, while simultaneously, maybe perhaps breaking up the true love story, Roy and Pam of the whole show, right? And demanding that the spotlight be shown on himself. So as a baseline right there, I just want to throw out this premise of Jim. This is my scene setting right here, right?
Gotcha.
This premise that Jim's the golden boy, that Jim is, you know, the heartthrob of the show. I think Jim is actually the true antagonist of The Office, depending on how you look at it.
Sure. No, it's an interesting point. Now, I will say, in my opinion, Dwight totally deserved it. But nevertheless, it is bullying behavior. I agree with you.
Right.
I don't see Dwight, like, it's very difficult for me to rewrite him as the protagonist of the show, or that, you know, he is this consummate, wonderful worker. Like, I think he inflicted as much damage as he solved by being a decent worker. So
I'm only going to agree with you on that because he's a well-known University of Washington graduate. So that means I have no respect or time for him. So
excellent. Anyways, let's go for your evidence on Jim here.
Okay, well, speaking of all the pranks and harassment and terrible things that Jim did to Dwight, I think it's in season one, it's one of the earliest episodes, they do this montage where they go through and list all of the things that that Jim has done to Dwight. So Michael's reading these reports, these incident reports of like all the things that Jim has done.
Right.
And one of the ones Michael reads says,
"This morning I found a bloody glove in my desk drawer and Jim Halpert tried to convince me I committed murder. I think he may be the real murderer."
So, you know, harmless prank on the surface, but then you stop and ask yourself, where did Jim get a bloody glove?
Yeah.
Was this really a prank? Like, is Jim trying to plant a seed of doubt or create misdirection? Or maybe he was just, you know, storing one of his murder weapons for the short term in his desk makes drawer and wasn't able to dispose of it before he stumbled across it. I mean, there are a lot of scenarios here. Okay, so a little circumstantial there in the beginning, but here's the next thing we need to think about with Jim. If you really put a magnifying glass to this theory that Jim might be this Grand Strangler, what you need to do is start to look at timelines. And what you really need to do is go like Beautiful Mind style and like put a bunch of photos up on the wall with like red string going everywhere, trying to connect the dots and figure out like when were people strangled and where was Jim.
See, I find it fascinating that you go to the movie A Beautiful Mind. For me, I was thinking about the bad guy in Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
you do your movie, I'll do mine. But if you were to do it, this is what you would find. And it's actually pretty striking. The Scranton Strangler subplot comes in and out of the Office TV series. But you know who else comes in and out of Scranton throughout that series? Jim. There are multiple points in the series where Jim is in a different city or is a character kind of outside the main storyline of the series.
Yep.
And there is no single instance in which there's a reference to the Scranton Strangler, which happens pretty regularly, that Jim is in Scranton. We only have references to the Scranton Strangler when Jim is actually in Scranton. When he goes to work in the other branch, the stranglings stop. When he goes to work in New York, no more stranglings. So,
you know what
who
this
knows,
tells
right?
me, though? This tells me that you have way too much time on your hands.
I told you I wanted to look in. I mean, it is Christmas. We should have mentioned this. It is Christmas Day right now.
Like
I had time in my day to work on this. There's a couple other things here with Jim. The first is his relationship with Meredith. So Meredith is the well-documented horn dog of the office, going around trying to sleep with everybody, and looks at Jim as an object of desire and sexual passion. Also, one of the greatest reveals in the show is that at the end, when they basically have gone 9 seasons showing how Meredith is like an alcoholic just trying to sleep with everybody, she points out that they did a really bad job editing and she earned her PhD in clinical psychology over the course of the show, which I thought was brilliant.
That's
but
great.
if you watch Jim and Meredith's relationship evolve over the course of the seasons, it goes from one where she's basically like just like over the top throwing herself at him, trying to get him to sleep with her in the first few seasons, to the culmination. I think it's like the second to last season, where the new manager of the office, Robert California, has a Halloween party where she's like actively terrified of him and won't be around him. And the thing that's really interesting about this kind of shift that we have where Meredith tries to avoid Jim at all costs is Meredith makes a comment like mid series somewhere where she basically said, like, she's talking about some of her sexual exploits and she's basically down for anything. But she says she has one thing that she draws the line at, and it's that she doesn't like anyone touching her neck. She
that's
goes,
right.
Any guy that wants to touch my neck, like that's the line, like those are the creepy ones. Like, and that's how I know it's time to run.
Right.
And so she seems to have like this sixth sense for this, right? Like an aversion for it. Like maybe Jim's setting off her spider senses here. As Jim goes further and further down the dark road of the Scranton Strangler as the season goes on, it becomes clearer and clearer in the reptile portion of Meredith's brain that she needs to stay away from him.
That's interesting.
Are you starting to creep over
to
my side a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I've got my own thoughts on this too, but I want to hear all your evidence first.
Well, there's one more incident with Jim and a lady, and this is also late in the series, but there's a random character, I don't even remember her name, who comes into the show for a few episodes. She's like either an intern or like a new entry-level person who's working in the office, and they have to go down to Florida for something, and they have adjoining rooms, and she's basically like she's also trying to seduce Jim, and they're in Florida, obviously. Jason, we've just talked about this whole like best way to hide a body, dispose of a body thing in our Halloween episode. Yeah, and Jim does the right thing. He's a married man. He resists the temptation. He declines her advances. But you know what's weird? The character never shows up again.
Just goes away.
She doesn't return to the office. We don't see her. There's no resolution. It doesn't close the loop on the subplot of this temptress trying to break up Jim and Pam's marriage. She just disappears. She never returns to the office from Florida. We never see her again. We never hear about her again. No one ever talks about it again. And she just happens to be in Florida. And if you've listened to our Best Ways to Hide a Body episode, right, you know Florida's top of the list.
That's where you go.
So again, we're just piling on the circumstantial evidence. You're like, what happened to this poor young woman who was just trying to get a little loving on a work trip, you know?
So let me see if I can condense all of this or just encapsulate what you've just said. So you've got Jim, who is a good-looking, smart guy, who is also a bully and sort of misogynistic, trying to break up relationships.
Yep.
Does a lot of traveling. He's always out of town when things are going awry, or you know, things seem to be going awry wherever he is located. You know who else fits that exact same description?
You're basically describing what's his name? They just made the Netflix series.
Yeah,
about.
You're talking about Ted Bundy. This is 100%.
He is Ted Bundy.
Yeah, I think that the show writers actually modeled the character Jim on Ted Bundy. So I think this one is not stupid.
Yeah, there's one more parallel here too, because look, when Jim and Pam first get together officially, it's like a fairy tale romance, right? And everything's perfect and it's like unbelievable. He's the perfect guy. I don't know how I could ever find someone so perfect. And then as it evolves, like they have real marriage trouble, right?
Yeah.
Like Pam feels like she doesn't even know them. Like their whole relationship goes on the rocks. And that's also pretty analogous to Ted Bundy. That's pretty much how it went down with his longtime girlfriend.
That's
right?
Exactly right. No, I'm telling you, I think The Office should have been renamed Ted.
All right. Well, I've got one more piece of evidence on Jim, but I want to save it till the end until we've examined all the suspects. So I'm going to reserve my call on stupid or not stupid on Jim.
Okay.
Until I can pull my final thread here.
Yeah. Right now, he's my second favorite suspect.
He's your second favorite.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting that you would remember that you phrased it that way, Jason. And we're gonna come back to that. So the next candidate here for the true Scranton Strangler that I want to talk about is Toby. Toby is the head of human resources at the office. And is the, I don't know, he's like the Eeyore of
the
office,
the
right?
Quiet,
like,
reasonable guy with no sense of humor. Yeah.
Okay. So you're familiar with Toby. Yeah. Okay. So I'm not starting from nothing here. Well, the one thing you may have noticed, I'm not sure if you got into the later seasons of The Office, Jason, but one thing that becomes a principal element of the character Toby is his obsession with the Scranton Strangler. Now, we have to give him a little bit of a break here, because Toby does end up serving as a juror during the trial of the supposed Scranton Strangler, and later goes on to espouse that person's innocence, and his whole identity seems to become wrapped up in letting people know that the person who was convicted of being the Scranton Strangler isn't actually the Scranton Strangler. And this is also pretty prototypical serial killer behavior, right?
Like I was going
to
say,
demanding to take credit.
Methinks he doth protest too much, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right? Right. Like, why is he so invested in people knowing that the real Scranton Strangler wouldn't do it this way, or the real Scranton Strangler, like, is probably still on the streets? Like,
no,
it just seems curious to me that
to your point,
he's so invested in it.
Yeah, we've seen with serial killers, it seems to be a relatively common trait that the thing that really makes them angry is if somebody else takes credit for their work.
There are a few things, even going back to the early episodes of the Office, that maybe laying the groundwork for Toby's homicidal tendencies. And one of the first ones is when Toby's going around the office putting on radon detectors everywhere. And Michael gets mad at him and says, "What are you doing? What is this crap you're putting all over the office?" And Toby says, "Well, it's radon. Radon's the silent killer." And Michael responds, "You're the silent killer." And if you watch and you turn the volume up, Toby's eyes shift to the camera. I feel like I'm going Jar Jar Binks all over
right,
again,
right
to the Jar Jar Binks episode. His eyes shift to the camera. And if you listen closely, you'll hear, you'll see.
These are silent killers.
You are the silent killer. Go back to the annex.
You'll see.
Michael?
Yeah.
And then he just walks away. So what does Toby mean when he says that? Michael calls him a silent killer. And what is his response? You'll see.
Yeah.
That's about the creepiest thing you could say in response.
If Michael doesn't like let him put the radon detectors in, then Michael is going to die of radon poisoning. Right.
It's possible. It's possible. But we're like in season one when that happens. I'm just saying that's like that's laying some groundwork.
Sure.
But let's look at the progression of Toby's timeline here.
OK.
There is a really uncomfortable scene to watch where like in season two or three or somewhere in there.
Well, first of all, it's The Office. That's the point. All of the scenes are very uncomfortable to watch.
Toby makes the decision once he realizes that Pam and Jim are getting together that he's going to leave and go to Costa Rica. I guess that's the other thing we should say here. The other big part of, you know, Toby's character is he's obsessed with Pam. Like,
right.
He's basically in love with Pam, right? That's like a defining part of his personality in the show.
Yes.
And he says that he's going to Costa Rica and Pam says how much she's going to miss him. And he decides to make his move in awkward, clumsy Toby fashion in a way that like no girl would ever go to for, admittedly.
Yeah.
But he reaches out and he puts his hand on her leg. And a lot of folks who've looked at this closely has said, if you look at the way that he puts his hand like on her leg, he kind of turns it to the side and then gives it kind of a squeeze, right? Like almost the way you would wrap your hand around someone's throat and squeeze. Now, I'm not saying that this is like an allusion to strangulation here.
A lot of people are saying.
a lot of people are saying. Because I don't actually believe at this point early on, I don't believe Toby... If you subscribe to this theory, and I'm not making a judgment yet.
Right.
But I don't think anyone's saying that at this point, Toby is the Scranton Strangler. But what you see is that there's something inside of him, something that is making that the default motion of his hand to put his hand on Pam's leg and turn it to the side and give it a strangulation-ish motion right on her leg until he realizes it's not reciprocated. And then to his credit, he pulls back and says like, oh, okay, thanks, Pam, and I'll see you after I go to Costa Rica.
So
we're just ramping up here.
Some of this evidence is interesting, but to me, so far, all that you're really proving to me is that if he's a serial killer, he has a whole lot of ability to keep himself in check. So I'm wondering if maybe we don't have like a Dexter scenario here, that like his whole plan is that he wants to kill Jim, right? Like, because Jim's the serial killer.
Yeah, he's really the hero. He's trying to protect the office from Jim. No, I actually don't think that's the case that's being made here. The case that's being made here is at this point, there is no Scranton Strangler, but the Scranton Strangler is about to be born.
Ah,
so anyone who follows, I can't remember if it's between season two and three or between season three and four, but Jim and Pam finally get together and that Toby goes off to Costa Rica. And the end of that, of the more recent season, then flashes to and closes Toby's in a hospital bed in Costa Rica because he got there. And like 4 days after arriving, he has a zip line accident. And what happens? He breaks his neck and he has to be put into one of those. I don't know what they're called. Basically, you get your vertebrae like screwed together and they put the bolts into your shoulder blades and you can't like turn your head one way or the other. Right. So he has a zipline accident and breaks his neck and spends 9 months in a hospital bed in Costa Rica.
Yeah. So the 9 months in the hospital bed is known as being in traction. What he had put on
traction. That's what it is.
What he puts, what he has put on him is called a halo.
Yeah. OK. So, yeah. So he gets the halo. So this is very interesting timing because up to this point, there has been no mention of the Scranton Strangler in the Office timeline. It's not a subplot in the series. So Toby goes to Costa Rica, breaks his neck, which last time I checked, you notice where your throat is located, breaks his neck.
Some of us.
And then returns to Scranton, after which the subplot of the Scranton Strangler is introduced into the series. So if something were to snap in Toby's mind, or he, you know, finally broke down that last barrier of sanity in his mind as he laid in that Costa Rican hospital in traction with his halo.
Like his mind snapped just like his neck. Yeah.
Just like his neck. Like, was the strangler unleashed? Was the last barrier, was that last mechanism of repression, you know, finally thrown out the window and the strangler was born?
It's difficult for me to imagine that a zipline accident leads to serial killing. But yeah, I understand your point.
Well, it may be difficult to imagine, but let me make it less difficult to imagine for you, Jason, because upon Toby's return, Pam and Jim get married And another interesting thing happens, and it's the next time that we hear from the Strangler. Jim and Pam get married, and they, you know, they make a baby, as newlyweds are want to do.
Yeah, and, after that horrible dance sequence at the wedding. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, where was the Strangler when we needed him, right?
Andy, you know, another person a lot of people suspect of being a candidate for the Strangler, but not someone who I really buy into. Andy does a nice thing, and he goes out and finds a newspaper of the day that the baby was, you know, scheduled for delivery. The baby was supposed to be born, and gets it framed so he can give it to Jim and Pam. And it says like a new day, like a new day for spring or something like that. It's like a really positive, hopeful headline. And he gets it all framed and he's going to give it to Pam. But unfortunately, the birth gets complicated and goes a little long, and the baby is born after midnight. So he has to go and trade the newspaper out. And what's the headline of the newspaper the next morning after Pam goes to the hospital? Scranton Strangler strikes again. Or another way to look at it is, while Pam and Jim are in the hospital and Toby finally sees that Pam is forever out of reach, that she's giving birth to Jim's child, and he will actually never be able to bring Pam in to this fantasy world that he's created for himself. What's the only outlet that he can find for his frustrations? How does he go out and deal with the heartbreak of this child being born that forever closes the door on his greatest wish?
He's got to
strangle someone. Not that kind of strangulation, Jason. Not that kind of strangulation. This would have been a much shorter episode if that was the crime That's being right. committed. Yeah, but I'm just saying, it seems like a pretty strange coincidence that on the night of the birth of Pam and Jim's child, also giving Jim an alibi, by the way. I guess I didn't really think about this.
All right.
But on the night of the birth of their child, the Scranton Strangler strikes again.
Well, we also, I mean, I don't remember the episode. Did we see Jim in the room while Pam was giving birth? Do we?
Yeah. So who,
could we account for him the entire time? Or like,
exactly.
I think that it's entirely possible. You know, we don't know where the strangulation took place. Maybe he just went out in the parking lot and, you know, did somebody in,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, I'm not trying to exonerate Jim here. I'm just saying that if Toby was the Strangler and he has to, as Dexter would call it, embrace his dark passenger at moments of high stress and anxiety,
yeah.
few moments could be of higher stress or higher anxiety than the woman you love giving birth to the child of the man you hate.
Okay. Well, you know, I was not at all convinced on this one at the beginning. I think I'm coming around a little bit. I think he's probably my third favorite.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got a little bit more. So okay. Let me see where you get.
Yeah, I don't think all of these evidence. Pieces of evidence are hits, but enough of them are that, you know, there's some smoke there.
Okay. Well, there's another scene, and like I said, Jim and Pam's relationship becomes stressed as the show goes on. And another thing that Toby's well known for in the office is the fact that he's divorced and his wife hates him and his daughter doesn't love him.
Yes.
And that he sits in depression in his cubicle, like looking at pictures of the family who want nothing to do with him.
Right.
Also kind of makes you wonder, what is the family sense in him that we don't?
Sure.
They want to be so separated from him. But Jim, whether it's, you know, right, feigned.
But a counterpoint to that, though, is he's so obsessed with this family that he's lost. You know, that is not the activity of a sociopath, right? The point of a sociopath is they keep those people around as a mask for their behaviors, but they don't actually have the feelings for those people.
I would say it's less likely that if Toby's the Scranton Strangler, that he's not a sociopath. He's just like obsessive compulsive. I think Jim's probably the sociopath.
Oh, which if he's not the Strangler, he is definitely a sociopath. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So whether it's a sociopathic cover or he's genuinely concerned, there is a scene in the later seasons where Jim comes to Toby and basically sits down with him and says, Toby, like, you had marriage counseling with your wife, right? Like before the end, like I'm having, like, he basically, is coming because he's having problems with Pam and he wants to understand from Toby, like, what's the deal with marriage counseling? Like, how does it work? And as Jim is asking Toby these questions, it all of a sudden clicks for Toby that he's not just like asking out of curiosity. that her and Jim, that Jim and Pam are having problems, and he all of a sudden gets very, very excited, almost ecstatic. If you watch the scene,
right.
But at the moment that he's kind of like at the height of his excitement, a newer character to the show comes in, Clark. Walks in and starts to ask Toby a question, and he snaps. He goes, "Get out of here! Get out!" and yells at him and tells him to leave so he can continue the conversation with Jim. And in the exact same way that we saw in the scene where Toby tells Michael that he'll see who the silent killer is, if you do the same thing and you turn the volume up and you listen, and we'll play it here, Toby says, "I'm going to kill him."
Hey, Toby, want to ask you a question, but
oh, sure.
It's a little personal.
Let's do it. Let's get personal.
I wanted to talk to you about your divorce.
Whoa.
Sorry. What I meant, honestly, was...
It's okay. I can handle it.
You guys obviously went through some tough times leading up to it. Okay. I was wondering if you ever did any couples counseling?
Oh, sure. Lots of times, yeah. Wait, you and Pam aren't in couples counseling, are you? Oh, God.
No. We're just starting couples counseling, which doesn't sound any better.
Even you guys. Kelly called it 2013.
So hey, no. Get out of here. Clark, get out of here.
My mistake.
Yes, it is your mistake.
It's lingering. It's so annoying. Kill him.
And that's the last thing you hear Toby mutter under his breath as Clark walks out of the room. So again, just another slip up, right? And they're all at times of high emotion, right? Like maybe Toby really did care about Radon. And when Michael mocked that, he unleashed that true kind of inner self hidden within him. And he let it slip out. A little bit of crack came through in the armor, and a little bit of it became visible. Same thing when he's at this moment of his highest hope, when he finds out Jim and Pam are having problems, and then Clark interrupts it. His immediate reflex is
right,
to say,
right.
"I'm gonna kill him."
But
so
right,
again,
no. So we were talking a minute ago about sociopathy. Well, the thing with serial killers is being a sociopath isn't enough, and being a psychopath isn't enough. You have to have both, right? And generally speaking, psychopaths don't say, "I'm going to kill somebody." They just do it.
Okay. All right. Well, look, if you want to stick it for Toby, that's cool. But let me get to the last kind of two things here, and then you can make the call, and we can see where we are. There's obviously the culmination of this whole thing comes when someone is arrested. Like, we have to talk about this, right? Like, someone is arrested for the Scranton Strangler murders. And, like, someone does go to jail, and there's a trial, and Toby gets selected to sit on the jury, which, you know, suspect in and of itself. Like, how did he arrange that? But there is a series of events leading up to this, specifically where the police get a lead or figure something out, like we're never told, but they identify the supposed apartment of the Scranton Strangler, and they surround it. They figure out he's not home, and then they identify his vehicle, presumably through some tip or maybe someone who survived the strangulation and saw the car. Like, they figure out, like, something that links a person to the strangulations, and it turns into a high-speed chase, which everyone in the office is watching on TV, and they identify the street that the police are chasing the car down, and they realize it's their street. So they all run to the window and watch the car fly by. And then they spend the rest of the episode, the rest of the day, basically sitting at the TV and like watching the chase as they try to go and get the Scranton Strangler. And there's a couple things here that are, it has to be intentional. Like, the showrunners like had to be putting this in here, like building up towards some sort of reveal that that Toby was the Scranton Strangler. But of the entire cast of The Office, the only person not present in this scene where the whole office is gathered and watching the chase take place is Toby. So Toby's not there. And the other thing, the car that the Scranton Strangler is supposedly driving that the police are chasing is Toby's car. And you don't see Toby driving his car, or there's never any scenes like this where Toby's actually in his car, like across the series. But if you go back and you're like a super sleuth and you see episodes where they just like get shots of the parking lot, you see the exact same make and model car. It's like a green gremlin sitting in the parking lot. That is, like, there's multiple times Toby's getting in and out of it. It's, like, totally innocuous. Unless you were, like, really looking, you'd never seen it. But it's a car that is identical that matches Toby's. So a couple things could be happening here, right? Like, what if there's someone like another Kevin, like someone who is a likely candidate to be a serial killer for whatever, like a person you would stereotype as a serial killer who just happens to drive a car that's very similar to the car of the real Scranton Strangler, and that car gets identified and linked to it. And so the police figure out who the owner of that car is, like, oh, it's a usual suspect. Like, of course that guy's a strangler, and he happens to have the same car as the real Scranton Strangler. So that's the first connection, right?
Ordinarily, I would write that off as completely unlikely and totally fictitious, except that that actually happened to me when I was 19. I got arrested suspect in a shooting because I was driving a car that was identical to the suspect.
See? So look, just a little bit of fiction or life creeping into fiction, right? So maybe you're having some empathy here for the argument.
In the 2010s, anyone who actually still owns a Gremlin is definitely a serial killer.
Okay, well, there is a possibility, right, that the person they're chasing is wrongly accused and it's the connection between the cars. But there's another darker scenario here that I think actually might be more likely. If you also watch that scene very closely, not only is Toby not there, but the phone at Toby's desk rings. And this is also interesting because that means someone's trying to reach him. But one of the other like tropes of The Office is that people call the main line and you get the classic office phrase, Dunder Mifflin, this is Pam. Like everything comes directly to the reception desk. And then Pam's whole reason for existence is essentially transferring calls from the front desk, like to the various sales desks in the office. But Aaron, who is Pam's replacement, who's the new secretary, is at the TV with everybody else watching.
So somebody had a
drama unfold. But Toby's phone's, someone had a direct line to Toby's desk. So it's someone he has an intimate connection to who would know how to get a hold of him, and he's still missing. So is this the Scranton Strangler or perhaps the Scranton Strangler's accomplice who's being chased by the police, who's on his phone frantically calling his partner in crime to figure out what they're going to do, tell him that they're busted, ask him for advice.
Yeah, you're going all DC Sniper on escape. This one.
I'm going full DC Sniper. I mean, think about this. Toby basically is not seen having any friends through the whole series. Like, no visitors, is completely alone. But someone has a direct line and happens to call him at this exact moment when he's, like, mysteriously absent. It's almost too many coincidences, if you ask me.
Fair enough. I'm still in love with the Dexter idea, though. So.
Well, and then the very, very last thing, you know, in the final episode of The Office, the last we see of Toby is as part of his like ongoing vendetta to prove that the I don't know if it's necessarily to prove that the Scranton Strangler who is in jail is innocent, or it's just to feed off the attention he gets by espousing this theory that the Scranton Strangler is innocent. And as one of the jurors, he's the person who can uncover the whole thing. He goes to visit the Scranton Strangler in prison, who promptly strangles him. And then he has to be carted out by paramedics, and he basically gets his voice box collapses, and
he's in traction, and he wears a halo again, right?
yeah, and that's how Toby's plot line ends. But the thing that's interesting about it is that you get this final scene with Toby, right? And throughout these like whole like dozen seasons or whatever the hell we got, the whole point of this is that the documentary crew had unfettered access. Like, even in like places where you think a camera crew couldn't go, like even in the most like personal of moments, the entire premise of the documentary of The Office is that their entire lives are recorded, right? And before Toby goes in to speak to this person who's being committed of the crime of being the Scranton Strangler, he just walks into the room to go talk with the guy, and the cameras don't follow. What did Toby say or do or insist on that even like when you see Michael walk away from his final scene, he has to take his voice box off that's recording all his audio and like hand it over to the crew? Like, how did Toby get into this room? Because we never see it on camera. We never see Toby being strangled by the quote unquote Scranton Strangler. He clearly has removed the recording device or the audio device that's attached to him, told the camera crews not to follow him, and then goes into the visitation area to have a conversation with this guy. and then comes out strangled? Is it that this was his partner in strangulation who was upset that he's basically taken the fall for him, or maybe saw Toby and couldn't control his need to asphyxiate a victim? Or is it that Toby was just going there to taunt the person who not only took the fall for him, but who Toby helped convict as a juror at his trial? And he went there to dangle that in front of his face and torment him. And that person reacted in the most ironic way possible, which was to lash out and strangle the strangler. Yeah. And Toby knew that might happen and knew he was going to confess his crime to him. And that's why he took off his recording device.
Two thoughts
and didn't
on this. First of all, the idea that he took off his recording device, actually, I don't find shocking at all. Like, you can't wear that kind of crap into a prison. Like, that's probably the guards having told him he had to turn all that stuff off, and the documentary committee couldn't, or documentary crew could not follow him into the room. That said, what I think probably happened was actually more of a Fight Club scenario, where he went in, he knew that he was the strangler and knew that this innocent guy was in there, but realized that the cops might be figuring this out. So he went in and strangled himself.
Ooh. Or he just went in to provoke the guy into strangling him. So there would never be any doubt, right? Like, well, yeah, he's obviously the strangler. Look, like, since he went to jail, all the strangulations had stopped. And the one visitor he's had, he fucking strangled. Yeah.
But I like the idea of him doing the Ed Norton in Fight Club and just, like, strangling himself while screaming, while the innocent guy in jail just stares on in horror. Yeah.
Okay, so before I kind of present my last one then and ask the final question, because that's everything I have on Toby, do you have any theories you want to throw out before I give you my final piece of evidence?
I do have one other candidate that I want to throw out, and then I have a final piece of evidence that I want to throw out as well. But I want to do it after yours, because I'm curious to see. We may have come to the same conclusion.
Okay.
But the one I want to throw out there, and I have absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever, I just want it desperately to be true. I want Angela to have been the Scranton Strangler.
Well, you never trust someone with that many cats.
And the fact of the matter is, I really just don't like the character of Dwight so much that I hope that after, you know, at the end of the series, when they move in together, she just killed him.
This is kind of a mean thing to say, and this is the back-to-back episode that it's been mentioned in. And I don't know if this is going to hurt his feelings or not, but this is another one for superfan Joey, friend of the show, who we need to get on as a guest at some point. But I've always joked with him that his wife reminds me of Angela, like not in the bad ways, but in the fact that she kind of looks like her, but in that she is like so organized and straight and narrow and like proper and is like essentially an accountant.
in Joey's defense, I've met his wife. She's incredibly sweet and nothing at all like Angela, aside from the fact like, that she is very organized. That's it.
Well,
she's funny, she's personable. Yeah.
But she kind of looks like her. I don't know. All right. Sorry, Joey. Anyway. Okay. So that's your Angela one. All right. So you want to, I guess you want my ruling then?
Yeah.
Okay. So the actual question was, stupid or not stupid, the Scranton Strangler worked in the office.
Right.
I think not stupid. I think the Scranton Strangler definitely worked in the office. I think it's a cop out to kind of say that as a final answer. So I'm going to name who I think the Scranton Strangler is. And we've now listed like what, five or six people. And I did them in the order of, now that you threw another one in, I did them in the order of like least compelling to most compelling, like building up to Toby where there's all this evidence. But because there's all this evidence that it's Toby, that's why I think it's absolutely not Toby, because you have to remember the most important rule of solving murders in the Office universe. And we get this from our Bayou episode again, going back to one of the greatest Office episodes of all time.
It's never the person you most suspect. It's also never the person you least suspect, since anyone with half a brain would suspect them the most. Therefore, I know the killer to be the person I most medium suspect.
And if you chart the map here of all of the folks who we've gone through, of all the varying degrees of suspicion, Jim Halpert was the person we most medium suspected.
Yeah,
so that's why I'm
think
saying
that's right.
Yeah. Jim has to be the Scranton Strangler because he's the person we most medium suspect.
Right. So again, like I said, he was my second favorite, Angela being my first favorite. I actually think you're correct about Jim, but I want to go a step further. What I believe is that Pam turned out to be a serial killer magnet, And I think that that entire office was populated with serial killers.
Oh, so they were all just like trying to get close to Pam. And she's like,
So there's a TV show on HBO or Netflix called The Sandman. It's based on a comic book back in the 80s. And there's a story arc within this first season of The Sandman where there's a serial killer convention at a hotel. they all just like convene under these, you know, weird circumstances and like talk about their craft, right? And I think that that's what The Office was. It was just a giant office full of serial killers who all knew that the other ones were serial killers and just tried to act as normal as possible to see who would snap first.
But here's the thing, Jason, this actually makes a ton of freaking sense, because they're actually, if you dive into like the Reddit threads on this, there isn't a person in The Office who doesn't have a thread dedicated to like why they are the Scranton Strangler.
That's what I'm saying. And that's because
they're all serial killers, right? Like one of them may or may not be the Scranton Strangler, but like that's Creed coming in covered in blood. Like that's the evidence. Yeah. Scranton Strangler, like, you know, Kevin's music, all the stuff with Toby, all the stuff with Jim. But like then you start really going down and you look at like Vance from Vance Refrigeration. There's like a whole subplot on how like he and Phyllis are like going out and like hunting for unicorns and essentially like kidnapping people in bars, and then he puts their corpses into Vance Refrigeration vans and disposes of them across the greater Pennsylvania area.
This is what I'm saying. Like, I totally agree with you that Jim is a serial killer. I just don't think you go far enough.
Like, and then that Gabe character who comes in, like creepiest motherfucker like in television history, like definitely a serial killer.
Yes.
Robert California, who's like the later boss of The Office, like total serial killer vibes. Jason, once again, you have taken something that has like proliferated the internet and branched out everywhere, and with no prep and no foresight, zeroed in on a theory that I haven't seen anywhere when I actually did research, and come to a conclusion that is probably the right one. Pam is a serial killer magnet, and they're all fucking serial killers.
Yeah, and that's not stupid.
It's not stupid. So yes, the Scranton Strangler worked in The Office. So did many other serial killers.
That's right.
Jim is the most medium suspected Scranton Strangler suspect, so it's probably him. But they're all killers.
But that just means he's the most likely to get caught. But yeah, they're all killing people. Yeah.
Scranton, Pennsylvania, serial killer capital of the world. All right. Well, I think we closed the book on this one. You got anything else?
No, that's it for me, man.
All right. Well, I don't know, Jason. Just like the Scranton Strangler, you've taken my breath away. I don't know what else to say. All right. Until next time.